This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the U.S. Constitution, if you read the Constitution, get your Constitution out. It's in Article 1, I believe. The Constitution says that any tax legislation shall begin in the House of Representatives. And as some symbolic constitutional ritual seems to take hold on the harrowing fiscal cliff negotiations, it is the GOP Republicans in the House who have offered the first real concrete plan for avoiding the so-called fiscal cliff. $880 billion in tax revenue over a decade, $1.4 trillion in spending cuts. Those are the opening numbers from the GOP, rejecting President Obama's $1.6 trillion deficit reduction offer that came out in some detail last week, proposing their own $2.2 trillion package if you add everything up. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. What do you make of that balance of revenue versus spending cuts by the GOP?
Well, it's a bigger offer, John, than the White House offered last week. You're right. But it's a starting point, because the other thing you have to know about it, of course, it was rejected out of hand by the White House. Why? Because that $800 billion in new revenue that you mentioned, which is in the Boehner plan, does not include any increase in the top rates. The White House has said now unequivocally any plan that doesn't raise marginal rate income tax rates on the top 2% rejected will be vetoed. So that was their response.
And the marginal rates, effective rates, what are the revenue raising provisions here? Where's the $880 billion coming from typically?
Well, the way Republicans want to do this is a way that they've been talking about for well over a year, which is to do tax reform that closes a lot of loopholes, special provisions, special interest tax considerations, closes those down, and deductions, by the way, closes those down and gets more money into the government. However, they say another thing along with that. They say you can do that while lowering rates on all earners, especially top earners, and still bring in that $800 or $900 billion in revenue. Now, Democrats have a real problem with this. They have a problem with this on two considerations. One, philosophical. They want tax rates to go up on the top earners. They think the rich aren't paying enough. They also say that that money that you get just from doing loopholes and deductions can never get you enough to reduce the deficit the way we need to reduce it. And what'll happen is if you only close loopholes, eventually we're still going to have a debt problem. And the only way to get the money then, since Republicans refuse to let rates go up on the rich, is to let rates go up on the middle class. They also say that closing a lot of loopholes and deductions, there aren't enough to go around just to do it on the rich. That means you have to hit a lot of deductions that middle class folks rely on. For example, the mortgage interest deduction is the biggest one in the tax code. If you hit that, it's a huge one that middle class people rely on.
Well, if Schmidt, are they going to take it out, the GOP, in this plan, or are they cagey on these specifics?
Unspecified. They say we need to get rid of deductions, loopholes, and special interest considerations, but not a single one is specified. And that, of course, has been a key Democratic criticism of Republicans all along. Sure, we can talk about loopholes and deductions, but you guys haven't mentioned which one you want to cut.
And, you know, without an itemization, I just see that this is not much more than a yes, we'll do some tax reform. Yes, we need to raise some rates. That it's an attempt to really argue philosophy, when what we need down to the wire here is a real sense of, you know, real dollars, real item line items, real spending cuts. So the time is not to be abstract right now, it seems.
Consider it a step forward in the sense that both sides have put a plan on the table and we've moved past the process arguments. For the last 2 weeks, we've had you guys are taking too long, or your offers aren't serious, or why did it take you 3 weeks to say this? Now we've moved beyond the process part of the argument to a numbers part of an argument. John, but you're right, it's not the kind of numbers that they're going to need to get a deal. And without any agreement on those top marginal rates in this agreement, that's a recipe for potentially going over the fiscal cliff, because the president has said with his own words over and over, if it doesn't contain an increase in income tax rates for the wealthy, I'm not going to sign this plan. So that's still a problem. However, keep in mind that they're really not trying to get a $4 trillion grand bargain deal right now. It can't be done right now. You can't make an agreement over the future of Social Security, the Medicare age, entitlements, and $4 trillion in deficit reduction between now and New Year's Eve. That's not going to happen. What they can do and what is still very possible is a deal that somehow reaches a deal on those top marginal rates, avoids the automatic spending cuts in the sequester, and then has some framework to say we come back next year and we do serious talks with consequences on those big issues I just mentioned. That's really, if they get an agreement, the outlines of what it's going
to
look like.
Well, that's a grand enough bargain to avoid the fiscal cliff, and grand it is. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Joining us now, Diane Lim, chief economist at the Concord Coalition, on the line from Virginia. Diane, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
Let's talk specifically about this marginal rates versus effective rates. There's this principle of we're not going to raise the marginal rates for the highest earners, and that's a deal breaker for the White House. And it apparently, if the White House wants that, it's a deal breaker for the GOP. But isn't the real path to getting the money necessary to make a significant reduction, doesn't it really involve effective rates, not so much the marginal rates? That's kind of symbolic at this point.
Well, right. There are lots of ways of getting more revenue from the federal tax system. You can do it through either broadening the definition of what's taxable, or you can do it by simply mechanically raising rates. And the debate has been mostly about what's going to happen to the top rates. Everyone, both sides, are claiming that they would prefer to raise revenue in base broadening ways, including the president in his budget every year has proposed some of this type of limits to itemized deductions. I think that the sticking point is what are you going to do to capital tax rates and in particular to marginal tax rates at the top? I think both sides are finding it hard to specify exactly how you broaden the tax base and raise enough revenue. And I think ultimately we're headed for some type of revenue increases that neither side is going to be perfectly happy with, because President Obama may have to break his promise to not raise burdens at all on any households below $250,000. And the Republicans may have to break their promise about keeping the top marginal rates as low as they are currently.
And if you lose that mortgage interest deduction, that's definitely going to hurt those households and break that promise. Does it break the promise for the GOP if, all right, the marginal rates stay the same, but if all of a sudden capital gains income gets taxed the way everybody else's income gets taxed?
Well, technically, the preferential tax rates now on capital gains and dividends, most economists consider that a tax preference that is not consistent with a comprehensive income tax base. But everyone on the Republican side, including Mitt Romney during his campaign, when he was presenting his platform on tax policy, it has been very clear that they don't want to raise capital tax rates or the definition of taxable capital income.
And does that get you there if you did that? I mean, I know that they're very certain about what they don't want raised, but if you did the math on capital gains, does it get you close?
It does. I mean, they keep invoking, everyone keeps invoking Simpson-Bowles' proposal or that approach. And in Simpson-Bowles, what they did was they were able to raise enough revenue through base broadening to actually lower overall marginal tax rates. But the way they had to do it is they included raising the tax rate on capital gains and dividends to the same rate as ordinary income, labor income. And Mitt Romney made clear during his campaign that he was not talking about that included in base broadening. So the math does not work well at all if you do not include capital income as part of your base broadening effort.
It seems, and you're an economist, and I suspect if you did live down there in the D.C. area, you spend a lot of time seeing the clarity of economics, such as it is, just sort of wrecked on the rocks of political ideology one way or another. But this does look to me like a fairly reasonable discussion, if they can turn down the rhetoric a little bit, of tax reform along with some base broadening of revenue increases. This seems a lot easier than it did before the election.
Perhaps. I mean, the language has been more positive, but yet they're still fighting about the specifics about how you broaden the base and keep rates low. I think people should keep in mind that just to deal with the fiscal cliff is really easy for Congress and the administration to do. They can just say, let's forget about doing any deficit reduction right now. Let's kick the can down the road, maybe 6 months, but let's make a commitment that in 6 months or a year that we come to some comprehensive agreement, bipartisan agreement that achieve certain revenue targets and spending targets. So if they can't come to agreement about how to broaden the tax base or how to raise rates right now, it's not required. It's not necessary that they do so. It might be more of an optics thing that Congress doesn't want to just kick the can down the road again because the American public have come to expect a little bit more from them after going through this election process.
Finally, before we go, would you consider it a responsible position to take the debt ceiling and the debt limit raising options away from Congress and have that be something, you know, about that the Federal Reserve would deregulate?
No, I actually think that keeping it as a congressional responsibility is a reasonable thing to do. You have to remember that increasing the debt ceiling is more of a technicality. I don't think we would ever consider not raising it because that would mean that we were reneging on our promises to our investors and treasuries, and I don't think our economy could handle that. I mean, that's far worse than going over the cliff or not going over the cliff. I think that it has served a useful purpose in that at least it's a reminder to Congress as they're busy debating legislation to increase the deficit. It's a reminder to them that, look, this is not an ideal situation. The American people are going to be watching. They're going to be made aware of the fact that our debt is still rising. It's a good reminder. It's a good check. And it's a speed hump along the way, so to speak. So I do believe that having a debt ceiling, a statutory debt limit, is a good thing. It's a good sort of communication device with the American people. It's a tough choice for the legislators, but it's good that they have to kind of admit to this need to keep increasing the debt limit.
All right, Diane Lim, contemplating scenarios even worse than the fiscal cliff. There, thanks so much.
Thank you.